Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Anwa Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Anwa Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther. And today we're talking to Major David Phillips, who recently won the Larry D. Welch Writing Award at U.S. Strategic Command. And so we thought we'd have him on. I mean, winning, you know, I've never won the Larry D. Welch Award for writing, and I write a lot. So, you know, I thought this was, why not have the, you know, the award winner? General Welch was an Air Force great and one of the, you know, the nuclear world's great leaders. And of course, so that's a, you know, a special award. So first of all, congratulations on winning that.
Thank you, Adam.
And, you know, of course, we're going to talk about his article. And, you know, one of the great things about the Air Force, and this is something I've noticed about the U.S. Air Force and the U.S. military, that is not necessarily true in the vast majority of militaries around the world. And that is that we are able to write and challenge current policy, current doctrine, current, you know, TTPs and strategy. We're able to do that as, you know, soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and guardians without having our careers destroyed. But of course, we recognize that we always do that in our own voice and not as representatives of, you know, our respective services. So I just say that to give you top cover. Now, you wrote this great article. Tell us about it.
Thank you, Adam. Before we begin, I would like to remind your listeners that the views I'm about to express are my own. They do not reflect the official policy or position of the Department of Defense or the United States government. In addition, I just like to remind and state that my comments are solely derived from open source material and are in no way associated with privileged information from the United States government. But moving back to your question, the why behind why I wrote this article. So as some of your listeners might know, in January 2024, two reputable career watchers, Robert Carlin and Siegfried Hecker of the 38 North publication with the Stimson Center, stated that the situation on the Korean Peninsula is more dangerous than any time it's been since early June 1950. Citing the failed 2019 Hanoi summit and recent changes in North Korea's national messaging, these authors asserted that North Korea has abandoned its historical goal to normalize relations with the United States and achieve peaceful reunification with the South. But even more alarming, they ended their article by saying North Korea could be preparing for war. And so this really got me interested in events going on the Korean Peninsula. And I wanted to study this topic further and figure out what was going on and where kind of the strategic landscape's at.
Yeah, that's a good one. So I've myself have written a couple of pieces about Korea and I, you know, it's, I'm really interested. And I think a lot of our listeners, because this is one of our sort of two or three major flashpoints. Okay. So you've delved into the topic, and then what did you come up with?
So the piece of information that I found missing in this discourse, so, you know, reading about this topic, and you see almost on a weekly basis, maybe every 2 weeks, that South Korean publications, articles, officials, somewhere in the ether, people are saying, we want nuclear weapons back in South Korea. And one thing that's missing in that discourse that I found was, what would it actually take for the U.S. to do this? So there's information on there on how much slick amend would cost as a program if the U.S. Pursued that capability. And we can talk more about that later if you'd like. But nowhere in there was there any information on how feasible, acceptable, or suitable it would be for the U.S. to return non-strategic nuclear weapons to South Korea. And so I started pulling on that thread, and that kind of led to my kind of main findings. And depending on how you want to do this, we can kind of dive straight into those or take them more broadly.
Yeah. So why don't we give us your main findings, and then we'll, you and I can have a discussion about that. Because I think this is what people will find interesting.
Yeah. So the first part, so I kind of broke up my article into three sections: feasible, acceptable, and suitable, as I already mentioned. And so in terms of the feasibility, you know, what there's a number of things you would have to have to do this proposal. So first is the weapons. So you need the right weapons. This would be the B-61 TAC-12 weapon, which is the only non-strategic nuclear weapon in the U.S. arsenal currently. You need the right aircraft, likely going to be the F-35A airframe. You need the right facility. So you're talking about weapon storage vaults, hardened aircraft shelters, underground weapon storage facilities, flight simulators, all the supporting facilities for the F-35. You need a number of additional supporting infrastructure, such as ops buildings, new security vehicles and maintenance vehicles. And then, of course, you need the personnel to actually man these new functions that you would be adding onto a mission out in South Korea. And so using historical research and numbers, accounting with a metric I came up with to account for inflation and some other factors, I was basically able to derive all these different numbers to come up what it would actually cost. Because as someone who works with the military, a lot of things come down to money and time. Those are two big factors that will always dictate the conversation. So first, looking at money, the inclusive upfront cost of implementing such a program could run anywhere between $2.6 and $3.7 billion. That's an upfront cost, and then recurring costs to sustain the program could run anywhere between $62 to $75 million a year. But let's put those numbers in context for a second. So the DoD's 2025 budget request from Congress is $848 billion. So not even accounting for the fact that you could allocate these funds over a multi-year period to build up the program, the total upfront costs of this proposal would only run you about 0.5% of the DoD's budget for next year. And again, the logical way to do this isn't to do all the money and pay for it all up front in 1 year. You would spread it over a 5 to 7+ year period to do that. So in terms of finances, it's actually quite an affordable program.
And the South Koreans, you know, at least the ones that I talk to, are, you know, more than willing to make a fair contribution to this.
So absolutely. You bring up a really good point. So if we kind of consider what we do in Europe and even with non-nuclear burden sharing in the ROC, yeah, we don't have to pay for this solely from the U.S. taxpayers' pocketbooks. And that's it. You know, we're at a really critical point right now when we look at the health of our finances as a nation. And so, you know, any way to keep the cost of a new defense program down while other costs are rising is quite important. And it really makes this proposal, I think, quite enticing.
Yeah.
So then, if it's okay, so I'll move into kind of the next area that I looked at with this this piece, which was the acceptability of doing so. So this is obviously looking at all the U.S. policy, South Korean policy, international accords that we would have to, you know, make sure they're in accordance with or require amendment to support this. So for anyone who's read the 2022 NPR, current U.S. policy is not quite accepting of the redeployment of non-strategic nuclear weapons at this time. This is mainly built on the policy goals to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. strategy, as well as to achieve the complete and verifiable denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Interestingly, however, there's another line in the 2022 NPR that I think has been overlooked quite too often. And I quote, it's that the United States will continue to field flexible nuclear forces suited to deterring regional nuclear conflict, including the capability to forward deploy dual capable aircraft and nuclear weapons in the Indo-Pacific. There's a little bit of paraphrasing in there. And a few words cut out in the middle, but that is a line straight from the NPR. And so what that tells me is that while right now this is not the direction the U wants to go in, they have left the door open to doing this under the right circumstances, which I think is an interesting finding.
Yeah, for sure.
And then I'll just close out with kind of the final main finding. So the suitability of this proposal. And so the question is this the right solution to the deterrence and assurance challenges we currently face on the Korean Peninsula? And so to that, I turn to the 2023 Strategic Posture Commission report that came out, and they identify a number of objectives delivery system attributes and implied requirements for a theater nuclear force capability. And so there's about five objectives, two of which would apply to the Korean Peninsula, those being addressing the need for U.S. nuclear forces deployed in or around the Indo-Pacific theater, a capability that addresses allied concerns regarding extended deterrence, and then five system attributes. And I'll briefly just go through these because I think they're important to highlight. So a forward deployed or deployable capability in the Asian Pacific theater, a survivable capability against preemptive attack without force generation day-to-day, a range of explosive yield options, including low yield, the capability of penetrating advanced air defenses with high confidence, and then an operationally relevant weapon delivery timeline, so promptness. So when you look at all the capabilities that are out there, there's kind of only two that could kind of come up to the table for a theater nuclear force capability. And that could be the redeployment of non-strategic nuclear weapons to the Indo-Pacific, or it could be maybe like the sea-launched nuclear ballistic missile, the SLCMN. And so the SLCMN, unfortunately, per the 2024 National Defense Authorization Act, will not, their initial operational capability per that legislation won't be until fiscal year 2035. So calendar year 2034, maybe in the September timeframe is the cutoff. But delays notwithstanding, that capability will not address the threat that the Strategic Posture Commission talks about, which is the period of 2027 to 2035, when U.S. adversaries are likely to challenge U.S. interests abroad. And so if you take their period of concern to heart, and you believe them, and I think there's good reason to believe the experts and that period that they came up with, there's only really one capability that we could field earlier in that period or within that period altogether that will address this emergent need that the commission has found. And that would be the redeployment of non-strategic nuclear weapons to South Korea.
Yeah. And this is something, you know, it's a great point. And I don't know if most people remember that we actually had thousands at one point of nuclear weapons in South Korea. So this is not something we've never done. It's not like we don't know where we'd put them. These are all things that we've thought about and done before. And so it's certainly a doable thing.
It is. And I think you highlight a really good point is up through 1991, we had these weapons in South Korea. That information's out there now. And so when we removed those weapons in 1991, this was, again, the post-Cold War era. The U.S. was emerging as the sole kind of dominant superpower in the globe. And then now we can kind of look back and say, you know, we had good intentions of showing that that North Korea and the region, that other nuclear capabilities didn't need to exist. That's why we pulled partially the reason we pulled them out. But unfortunately, that's not the future that developed. Our adversaries have built up their nuclear weapon capabilities, North Korea and China. And meanwhile, we don't have anything to address that threat on a capability-to-capability basis right now. And so, the title of the paper is specifically called redeployment for a reason. It's not initial deployment. This is a return to something we've done before, something we're capable of doing, something that we currently do right now in Europe and with our NATO allies. And I think those are important points to highlight.
So as you did the cost assessment, which means you clearly looked at, you know, do we have to build new aircraft, hardened aircraft shelters? Do we need to put new vaults? And I think, you know, it's clear the vaults are gone and, we've sort of disassembled the capability. But were you able to find any information that sort of explained, like, how quickly, if we wanted to put new vaults back in the ground, you know, in hardened aircraft shelters, how long would that take?
Sure. So, I did some research into kind of the military construction timelines. You know, there's quite a process for the military and government to build these things. And you have to go through Congress, get funds appropriated, and then you have to have those funds available. There's a lot of legal topics to work through. So vaults and all other things included, it's my assessment that probably 5 to 7 years would be a reasonable amount of time that it would take for the U.S. to fully build and you know, follow through with military construction of all these activities. So, you know, I don't have the name of the company who built our original vaults back there at the top of my head, but I did find it in my research, and that information, that company still exists. They're still out there. So that information still is something that we can pull from as a government. It's not building something from scratch. We're just going to blow off some dust off the old plans, look at what we've done in Europe to modernize these efforts. And I truly do believe with the right will and interest in doing so, we could get these fielded within that 5 to 7 year period.
Yeah. Now it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break. So we'll do that. And we're talking to Major David Phillips, the Larry D. Welch Award winner from U.S. Strategic Command. We're talking about redeploying nuclear weapons to South Korea. And we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the ANWA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back. And before the break, we were talking about, you know, what it would take to redeploy. And you said 5 to 7 years. Now, I'm pretty sure if you know, the need were there, we could do that in 12 months or less. Sure. But, you know, the bureaucracy is a terrible and vicious thing. And so it, of course, slows everything down. Did you look at if we wanted sort of a temporary or an immediate deployment? And because we wanted a presence on the pen of, you know, nuclear weapons to, you know, deter aggression. Let's suppose hypothetically war kicks off with over Taiwan, North Korea's, you know, thinking, ah, this is our big opportunity. And we say, you know what, we'll deploy some, you know, some F-35s and with B-61s to make sure that the North Koreans don't think it is the opportunity. Did you look at anything like that and what that might take?
So I appreciate the question. That goes kind of outside the scope of what my research looked at. But what I will say, and it kind of goes back to something we briefly talked about earlier, is there is that line in the NPR saying that we'll have the capability to do so. And I really, at the end of the day, to do what you suggested is ultimately just a conversation about risk. What level of risk is the U.S. willing to accept to provide an emerging capability in a very short period of time? And so, if you believe that line in the NPR that we'll retain the capability to do just that, then yeah, I believe we could do it in short order. And there's probably ways that the department, if they were serious about doing so, could augment with additional security forces and other capabilities and defense posturing to do that in a quicker period if necessary.
Yeah. And so as you were doing your research, what were probably, you know, sort of the most, I don't know if I want to call them like, oh, or aha, or, ooh, that's interesting, I hadn't thought of that. What were those things that jumped out at you?
You know, so when I dived into this research, one thing that really caught my eye, and there's a individual at MIT, MIT Security Research Program that talked about this, and they call it South Korea's nuclear hedging strategy. So maybe some of us have heard of nuclear latency and some other topics about kind of there's some positioning potentially going on. But they kind of lay out what they call nuclear hedging, which is that the ROC is positioning itself to develop a nuclear capability in short order, should it ever decide it needs to do so. And there are push and pull factors to do so or not to do so right now. But if you kind of read the tea leaves a little bit and look at kind of what's going on in the pen, then I think you start to see that there are certain actions and capabilities that they're continuing to develop while conventional right now could be transferred into a nuclear capability in short order, and by short order within a number of years, a few number of years, that they could transition those into nuclear capabilities and find ourselves in a really interesting and hopefully not the situation we find ourselves in, but where someday South Korea could say, hey, we have nuclear weapons on our own and kind of do what we saw India and Pakistan do a few decades ago.
Yeah, it's interesting because I was talking to some senior officials in South Korea, you know, and just sort of feeling out their sort of where do they stand and how serious are they? And what was interesting is they used the analogy. They said, well, you know, Adam, you know, South Korea is really the Israel of Asia. And if, you know, you support Israel and they're a, you know, they're a small country who's a, you know, a Western democracy with a free society surrounded by, you know, authoritarian regimes and illiberal countries. Well, that's us. I mean, we're a small Western democracy with a free society. And, you know, you know about the Chinese because you're afraid of them too. And you've seen what the Japanese did to us and the North Koreans. And you know, so therefore you have to understand why we would want to go nuclear. And it's, you know, it's kind of a hard argument to say, ah, that's a foolish argument. But for some reason, the United States, you know, is more concerned about ensuring that, you know, we have non-proliferation as opposed to, in many respects, acknowledging the security concerns of our allies. And I wonder, as you look at, because I'm sure you looked at, you know, the Washington Declaration and sort of how that's played out in, you know, that span of time, the year plus that it's sort of been in effect. Do you see the Washington Declaration as being effective in, you know, making the South Koreans, you know, think to themselves, you know what, we're good. The Americans have done everything. We're safe now. Or do you think it's sort of, you know, been somewhat effective? How do you see it?
So I think it depends on what audience in South Korea you're talking at. And I know you did some research on this, and the Center for Strategic and International Studies has done some surveys of this as well. And so if you look at the South Korean population at large, in the year and a half since the Washington Declaration, their confidence in U.S. extended deterrence has not increased. In fact, it's actually trended in the wrong direction. Now, if you look at a different category of people, which some have called, you know, South Korea's strategic elite group, there is less interest still at the moment on having their own, pursuing a domestic nuclear capability. I think the numbers run in kind of the 30-40% range. But, you know, if the security situation continues to degrade, that's those same surveys from the Center for Strategic and International Studies suggest that those same elites might kind of, some of them might move over to the nuclear capability camp and develop their own capability, and you find yourself in a different group. And of course, we can never forget the comments of President Yoon back in 2023 talking about the need to develop a nuclear capability. Now, again, this was before the Washington Declaration. And so I think among government officials, there have been some curbing of the appetite to develop a nuclear capability based on those who kind of have a little bit more access to information. But for the South Korean public, they have not yet been assured fully that where we're at is where we need to be.
So as you walk away from, you know, writing this article, and, you know, you've sort of made up your mind, what is your take, and you know, what would you go advise, you know, American senior leaders on this topic?
You know, I think it's interesting because this topic, it almost felt like a taboo topic. Like, this is just not a course of action that we can talk about. This is just not what we want to do. But when we look at, you know, kind of where the strategic landscape is today, you know, go back a few decades, it was the European theater in the Cold War between Russia and the United States that was the theater of interest. And now the theater of interest is the Indo-Pacific. And unlike what we have and what we did back then in the European theater, is we don't have an analogous capability currently in the Indo-Pacific. And so to, you know, ensure that our adversaries of the United States and our allies don't get into military adventurism and do something that causes, you know, a bad day for everyone across the globe, we need to make sure that we have the capabilities to dissuade them and say, today is not the day that we're going to try to take aggressive action, whether it be North Korea against South Korea or the PRC against Taiwan. I mean, as we know, these are hot zones where conflict could kick off. And so we need to make sure we have the capabilities to prevent that. And again, just retying it back into that Strategic Posture Commission 2027 to 2035 period, if we continue on the trajectory we're on, we're not going to change the calculus too much for our adversaries. It's going to kind of just be what it is right now. And they're building up fast. And if we don't do something, then we could find ourselves in that really awful bad day scenario where a conflict goes hot.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. That's, you know, it's one of my favorite sort of quotes to remember is, you know, he wasn't always everybody's favorite Secretary of Defense, but, you know, Donald Rumsfeld, you know, very famously said weakness is provocative. And when you're dealing with, you know, authoritarian regimes who come to power and, they exercise power and force, then, you know, our good intentions are not something that seems to make sense to them. They perceive that as weakness. So, you know, sometimes strength is, you know, there's another Reaganism, you know, that is peace through strength. So I certainly get that. Now, I want to go ahead and bring out my good friend, Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp, and Bob, of course, grants all visitors to NucleCast the three wishes. And, but they gotta, you know, stay on our topic. So as you make your wishes for Bob the Genie, David, what is your first wish?
So my first wish is that the message of my paper reaches the right audiences. And there's specifically three groups that I want to highlight. So first is senior leaders in the U.S. military. So at the Deterrence Symposium just over 2 weeks ago, I was very fortunate to have the chairman and General Anthony Kahn of United States Strategic Command in attendance, as well as a host of other nuclear experts and those that are in the field to hear this message and at least have some awareness of this proposal that I put out there. But beyond that, I also think that there's leaders in the staffs of the Headquarters Air Force and the Joint Staff that I really want to make sure that they hear about this topic and just have awareness of it. The second main category is U.S. civilian leaders and elected officials. And so, as everyone knows, we're in an election year right now. And so I hope that the right staffers and cabinet, future cabinet personnel for whichever incoming party eventually takes the White House also get awareness of this proposal. It's important to highlight that there's momentum beyond just what I've written and other kind of in the think tank community for this type of proposal in Congress. So Senator Roger Wicker, the ranking member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, as well as Senator Jim Risch, the ranking member of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, both have public statements on the record calling for the redeployment of non-strategic nuclear weapons to South Korea. And that's huge. And so that shouldn't be lost, that it's not just a good idea. It's that there's some momentum here. And in election year, you know, this is an opportunity. There's going to be a new president come next year. And so there's an opportunity to maybe review our approach. The final audience I'd like to have for my first wish is that South Korean civilians and military officials are also aware of this. So enacting this type of proposal will require the right push and pull factors between the United States and South Korea, the South Korean government, to make this type of proposal happen. And so it's my hope that senior officials in South Korea can be a key support and aware of this topic. And if it scratches the itch, which I believe those who look at this issue, it definitely would meet a need that's been out there, that they can also continue to engage with the United States on this topic.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So those are good wishes. I think Bob will, you know, I've got him convinced to go ahead and grant those. So now, second wish.
So my second wish, and it's a little bit related, is for U.S. policymakers to continue to have fully informed conversations regarding the deterrence and assurance challenges we face on and around the Korean Peninsula. So my research suggests that the United States should re-examine its stated policy goal to achieve denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. I don't think we should forget that Kim Jong-un last year had a speech during a Supreme People's Assembly meeting, which stated that North Korea's nuclear force building policy is now permanent as the basic law of the state. Likewise, it's important to remember that among those nations with nuclear weapons programs, North Korea is the least invested in the current rules-based international system. To say this another way, Kim Jong-un has the least to lose and the most to gain from continuing its current posture of aggression and hostile actions against South Korea and the United States. It's my belief that we need to recognize that the current direction of U.S. foreign policy toward North Korea is highly unlikely to yield any meaningful concessions, which means that staying the course will only permit this problem to fester and ultimately lead to greater deterrence and assurance challenges in East Asia in the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's certainly true, and I think a good wish. Okay, so your third and final wish from Bob.
So my final wish is that the U.S. does not shy away from taking bold action to ensure strategic stability in East Asia. A consistent theme at the United States Strategic Command Deterrence Symposium held a few weeks ago was the need for bold ideas and innovation. We need to confront the reality that new capabilities and force posturing requirements are going to be required to maintain strategic stability in East Asia within that 2027 to 2035 period. I think the Atlantic Council, in a report they published last year, may have said it best when they suggested that capability enhancements by the DPRK and PRC are very likely to drive a dramatically increased risk of strategic deterrence failure on or around the Korean Peninsula in the next 5 to 10 years, while the current trajectory of South Korean and U.S. deterrence capabilities and approaches look unlikely to effectively mitigate these risks. It is my strong belief that the deployment of non-strategic nuclear weapons to South Korea would strengthen deterrence insurance in the regions. And I'd like to assert that enacting such a proposal is similar to a strategic insurance policy for the United States. Insurance exists to manage future risk. And should deterrence or assurance on the Korean Peninsula fail, the capability to redeploy non-strategic nuclear weapons to South Korea would pay off when it's needed the most.
Yeah, that's a fair point. But, you know, it's going to take a leadership that is unafraid of the arms control and disarmament community. And then maybe we can make some smart decisions. So thanks, David, for joining us on NucleCast.
Thank you so much, Adam.
And of course, so go out. Where can we find your article? Tell everybody.
So my article is currently posted on ResearchGate, and maybe Adam and I can work afterwards to make sure that link's available somewhere for your listeners. And then it'll be published by the Center of Strategic International Studies by the end of this year in their On the Horizons journal.
Okay, so we'll work to add that to when we do the social media and LinkedIn. We'll try to put that link up there, and you can go ahead and take a look at it. So, all right. Thanks, David. And of course, thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode of NucleCast, and we'll see you next time. Well, good topic for a NucleCast discussion, of course. I mean, should we return nuclear weapons to the pen? What's a better topic for us to talk about? So it was good to have David. You know, he won the Larry D. Welch Award. That was, you know, that's a big deal. So that was, I'm glad to see him do that. And, you know, go out, read the paper. I think he said it's on ResearchGate. We'll post it. You know, give it a read, see what you think, and maybe reach out to him and give him your feedback.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.